Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of whether the just-signed P5+1 deal with Iran was a clever bluff on the part of Iran to negotiate away a nuclear program they never had and never intended to have. William Beeman, a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and author of The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other, joins us to discuss his article at New American Media, Iran Won the Vienna Accords by Agreeing to Stop What It Never Was Doing, and what he saw on a recent trip to Iran of a country that is self-sufficient with a GDP growth, according to the IMF, of 3% last year, with less poverty than the United States. Then we'll get a flavor of life inside of Iran from the perspective of an American teenager who was transplanted from Brooklyn to Tehran and had to adapt and conform to life in an oppressive society controlled by religious police. Shagayeg Fasijani, a former reporter and anchor, joins us to discuss her new book, The Burden of My Red Lips in Tehran, and how Iranians in the diaspora feel about the possible opening up of Iran to the outside world. Then we'll speak with Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, a retired professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases. He was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peacefully protesting on Moral Monday, and we will discuss the massive demonstration last Monday in Winston-Salem against the North Carolina's legislature's naked voter suppression and blatantly discriminatory laws that are being challenged by the Justice Department, the NAACP, and the League of Women Voters in a federal trial underway in Winston-Salem. And joining us now is William Beeman, who is a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. Best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years, he served as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress. He's the author of 14 books, including Language, Status, and Power in Iran, The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. And his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. He also has an article at New American Media, Iran Won the Vienna Accords by Agreeing to Stop What It Never Was Doing. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Beeman.
Thank you very much. I'm so delighted to be with you.
And explain the idea that Iran was able to, I'm just quoting your article, was able to win because it was very easy for it to bluff by giving up activities in which it had never engaged and never intended to engage. Expand on that, if you will.
Well, there was never any evidence, any place at any time that Iran actually had a nuclear weapons program. A new article has come out since I wrote this one by my colleague Gareth Porter, an award-winning journalist and researcher and historian. Porter points out that Iran in the late 1990s had no nuclear enrichment program, but they did very much want to see the unilateral sanctions that had been imposed by the United States, and especially during the Clinton administration, reduced, but they couldn't get the attention of the United States. Madeleine Albright, who was then Secretary of State, tried very hard to make overtures to Iran to try to get Iran and the United States talking to each other after 35 years of estrangement. But she was blocked by the Clinton administration, who was trying to show that they were the strongest supporter of Israel of any presidency ever. So Iran began to exercise its right under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to peaceful nuclear development by beginning a program of uranium enrichment. Like 19 other non-nuclear weapon states who were also signatories to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty were doing, including Japan. And Japan had said that it would develop nuclear weapons if it needed to in the future, and also Argentina and Brazil that had nuclear weapons programs in the past. None of those nations had ever been attacked for their nuclear enrichment program. So Iran began this as a way of developing fuel for nuclear reactors in a program that paradoxically the United States had started 40 years ago by selling Iran on the idea that they needed nuclear reactors in order to be a modern state and to save their oil resources. So Iran's development of nuclear enrichment immediately set off an alarm in the United States because the Israelis in particular and Israeli surrogates in the United States, like the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, immediately tried to insist that Iran was developing a bomb and was a weapon and was a state that was a danger to Israel. The United States, during the Bush administration, was also interested in trying to create regime change in Iran. And it was convenient for the Bush administration to take the idea of an Iranian nuclear danger as a way of selling the idea of regime change in Iran to the American public. This started in 2003. But Iran never had a nuclear weapons program. And in 2007, 2011, the National Intelligence Estimate affirmed that Iran never had a nuclear weapons program. The International Atomic Energy Agency never stated that Iran had a nuclear weapons program. Quite to the opposite, they said that Iran had never diverted fissile material for a military purpose. So Iran came to the negotiating table in 2013 and essentially was playing off of the fact that the United States continued to insist that it had a nuclear weapons program. Now, without admitting it, Iran was quite easily able to give up their non-existent nuclear weapons program as a bargaining chip in these negotiations. And, of course, their ultimate aim was to get the sanctions removed, which they had been trying to do for nearly two decades.
So I don't understand then, if you're bluffing, like in a hand of poker, you've got worthless cards, but there's a huge pot on the table, why would you subject yourself to years of an assault on your standard of living, an enormous amount of money that was lost from the, particularly the oil embargo, to cut Iran's revenues from foreign exchange in half? And furthermore, it's not just the United States that was negotiating with Iran. It's the P5 plus one, which is the UN Security Council, including Russia and China, that don't necessarily see eye to eye with the United States. So why did all of these other nations weigh in if this whole thing was a hoax?
It wasn't a hoax, but the sanctions that were already in place, the unilateral sanctions on the part of the United States, had absolutely nothing to do with Iran's nuclear program. They were first imposed by President Reagan, and then they were increased under the Clinton administration. And at that time, the United States was not concerned at all about Iran's nuclear program. We knew about it. We had started it. We actually funded Iranian nuclear scientists to come to the United States and learn about nuclear energy. In fact, Iran's chief nuclear negotiator was a classmate of Energy Secretary Muniz at MIT. So we knew about the nuclear program. We knew that what Iran was doing. But Iran could not get the attention of the American government to negotiate an end to these unilateral sanctions that had already been established. And during the Bush administration, the Bush administration wanted very much to effect regime change in Iran. And that was so the situation escalated with Iran developing a uranium enrichment in order to get the attention of the U.S. During the Bush administration, twice the Iranians tried to get the United States to come to the negotiating table to talk about the removal of these sanctions and also about Iran's nuclear program. Twice the Bush administration rejected these ideas, and in 2005 they strong-armed our European allies to keep them from talking to Iran about these things. So Iran was continually making these attempts to try to get the United States to negotiate. But the Bush administration still thought that they could overthrow the government of Iran, and they were not interested in talking to the Iranians at all about anything that would be a negotiation that would relieve the Iranians from pressure. The Obama administration, for the first 4 years of the Obama administration, they continued thinking that they could pressure Iran into giving up its nuclear enrichment program. but they no longer had the idea of regime change on the table during the Obama administration. That was gone. And so the United States had actually no particular reason for trying to deny Iran its rights under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, except for the idea, the fantasy, that Iran was actually building a nuclear bomb. This is something they inherited from the Bush administration as a piece of propaganda. They managed to convince the Europeans, and actually this had already started in 2006, the Bush administration convinced the Europeans and the United Nations to impose these sanctions on Iran, and the Obama administration was stuck. They were left with the Bush-era sanctions, and they had no easy way to extricate themselves from this situation. If you remember, President Obama faced re-election in 2012. He just came into office in 2008, and anything he would have done during his first term that would have involved talking to Iran, actually negotiating with Iran, was going to be attacked by the Republicans as going soft on an enemy of Israel or soft on a sponsor of terrorism or any other number of propaganda statements that they would make. So the President Obama had to wait until after the elections in the congressional elections in his second term to be able to actually move forward with these negotiations. And he did, and as you can see, they've been successfully concluded.
But it still remains a puzzlement to me, and I'm sure to our listeners, that the sanctions, particularly on oil sales, which really have hurt the Iranians, was joined by Russia and China as well as the Europeans. And the point makes a mockery of this ridiculous fellow that's running for president, the governor of Wisconsin, who hasn't read the deal but came out of the gate straight away condemning the P5 plus one deal with Iran and saying that if he's elected president, he would ramp up crippling sanctions against Iran. Well, you can't cripple Iran with American sanctions alone. And as you point out on the trip that you just got back from Iran on June the 21st of this year, other Western businesses are already in there looking for business opportunities. So sanctions don't work unless other countries buy into them. And that's what happened. The other countries bought into them. This is not the U.S. alone that's sanctioning Iran.
That's correct. And as the president has just pointed out in his news conference, if the U.S. Congress rejects this deal that's been done in Vienna, the other nations in the P5 plus one, plus China, plus Russia, plus Japan and other people who are customers for Iranian oil and other goods are simply not going to go along with it. The sanctions regime will fall. And it's very and the United States can continue to try to impose unilateral sanctions against Iran, but those unilateral sanctions were not very effective to begin with. They were an annoyance, but Iran was able to develop in the last 20 years an extraordinarily robust infrastructure, both in terms of its industry and its commerce. And people who believe that Iran has somehow fallen into some kind of horrible economic pit and they're desperate to get these economic sanctions have not been to Iran. You haven't seen the fact that the country is absolutely booming with infrastructural development. Factories everywhere, mining, agriculture, everything is going very, very well. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank both affirmed that Iran had a GDP growth of 3% last year. That's larger than that of the United States. So we forget that nations can have an internal economy that's very robust, even if their foreign trade might be crippled by something like sanctions.
And also, Iran has a poverty rate that is lower than the United States. So
it's not only lower than the United States, it's lower than Japan, lower than Australia, lower than many, many nations around the world. So it is not the situation that that Iran could never withstand a sanctions regime. It's extremely inconvenient for them now because they can't export or import foreign currency, so foreign trade is hampered. But even then, the Iranians have lots and lots of workarounds. They work through Dubai, they work through India, they work through other nations in order to get their foreign trade going. As a matter of fact, Iran's trade with Europe last year amounted to 150 billion euros. Now, that's not a lot of money on an international scale, but it does show you that that Iran has not been completely hampered in terms of trade by working through third nations and through other kinds of arrangements.
Well, indeed, the oil embargo has actually helped consolidate the power of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, because they're selling the oil through Iraq on the black market.
Yeah, that's correct.
And go ahead.
I'm sorry. The Revolutionary Guard Corps is the source of much opposition to this deal in Vienna on the part of internal forces within Iran. One of the reasons is because they have such a tight control over the import and export of goods, sometimes through illicit channels. And they know that if the sanctions are lifted, that all of a sudden the floodgates will open for trade with Iran, and they'll no longer have that exclusive control that they did over so many areas of the economy.
But just to explain your thesis that this was essentially a bluff, that Iran knew it didn't have a nuclear program, we've ginned up this fantasy or this, you know, this specter of an Iranian nuclear bomb, and they put up with a lot of deprivation going along with this bluff in order to be rewarded by this deal. So the question would be, what's the trade-off? Did what they suffered for the last few years, is it worth what they're going to get? I just find it, I don't understand the calculus.
Well, the sanctions were imposed by the United States. Iran insisted from the very beginning that it was never developing a nuclear weapon. It did. There were fatwas issued. There were innumerable statements made by the Iranian government that they were not building a nuclear weapon. There was no evidence from any intelligence agency anyplace that, or any military agency anyplace, including Mossad in Israel, that Iran actually was building a nuclear weapon. So this wasn't something that the Iranians cultivated. This was a fantasy that the United States chose to believe. And it was, of course, started by the Bush administration in 2003.
Right, but the bottom line here is that if it's a fantasy, the Russians and the Chinese, the Germans, the British and the French went along with it.
They went along with it because the United States strong-armed them
in the
most intense way. You have people like Nicholas Burns running around the world and other ambassadorial people running around the world talking about the fact that Iran was likely to build a bomb and was going to bomb them in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and places like that. Now, why the Russians and the Chinese eventually went along with it? Because they did not at the very beginning. They dragged their heels for a very long time. Why the Russians and the Chinese went along with that is a story that's yet to be told, I think. But as you can see, the Chinese and the Russians have not been particularly cooperative with everything on the American agenda. They want to resume trade with Iran. They always did. And they were willing to put up with the imposition of these additional sanctions in order to guarantee that the United States would come to the negotiating table. That was the promise that the Obama administration made to them. They said, if you'll go along with us in putting pressure on Iran to get to the negotiating table, we will also be there. And you've got to understand that until 2013, the United States had not talked to Iran at all. It was the case during the Bush administration that American officials were under orders that if, for instance, they went to an international meeting and they happened in the hallway to come across an Iranian official, they were to turn around and walk away so that they wouldn't even greet the Iranian official. It was that serious. So the idea of actually coming to the negotiating table and actually sitting down and speaking face to face with the Iranians was something that was completely new. It had not happened in 30-some years. And for this, the Russians and the Chinese were persuaded that it was worth going along with these sanctions, which, by the way, they really didn't observe. they were going along with it in name only. Trade with China continued with Iran, and of course the Russians were supplying uranium and other supplies to Iran as well as arms. So whether the Russians and the Chinese might have seemed in some way to be going along with the sanctions, but really they didn't observe them.
Well, I certainly would like to learn more about why Russia and China went along, even if they were doing stuff through the back door. They certainly did cut back on the Chinese cut back on their oil purchases, along with the Japanese and South Koreans and others. But what I find puzzling about this deal is that Putin has signed on to this deal, and yet it means that beginning next year, Iran will be putting its oil on the market, which will already lower the price of a market that's under a glut of oil from the Saudis. So that's going to lower the price of oil even more as Iran's oil comes on. And Russia is suffering enormously from the drop in the price of oil. So that's a real puzzlement.
Well, it's of course a calculus on the part of the Russians. They certainly expect to get trade from Iran in other areas. And their neighbor of Iran, a major neighbor of Iran, they're deeply involved with Iran's nuclear industry, the nuclear energy industry. They're going to receive the agreed upon enriched uranium that Iran has agreed to ship out of the country. Russia's interest in Iran goes back 200 years. They've had a major interest in Iran for all that time. So it's not surprising that the Russians would be interested in some kind of renewed relationship with Iran. They expect to have major influence with Iran in the future, and certainly if the United States doesn't ratify this agreement, you can bet that the Russian influence in Iran is going to be much, much greater than it even is today.
Well, William Beaman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're most welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with William Beaman, who's a professor and the chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. Best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years, he served as a consultant to the United States Department of State, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress. He's the author of 14 books, including Language, Status, and Power in Iran, The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. And his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. He also has an article at the New American Media, Iran Won the Vienna Accords by Agreeing to Stop What It Never Was Doing. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into what life is like in Iran for an American teenager who was transplanted from Brooklyn to Tehran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Shagayeg Fasijani, who was a former reporter and anchor, turned author and poet. She was taken back to Iran at the age of 15 when her father made the unilateral decision to uproot the family from Brooklyn, New York. Upon her return, she traveled the world extensively and decided to share her story as a young woman during some of the most heated years in Iran's modern history. Her new book, The Burden of My Red Lips in Tehran, reveals how female teenagers adapt and conform to life in an oppressive society while navigating its many obstacles. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shageyeg Fasijani.
Yes, thank you.
And obviously there's a tremendous amount of celebration in Iran. I think some of the hardliners aren't too happy, but it seems like the majority of the population, at least from what we can tell, are rejoicing. And there's even an expectation amongst a lot of the diaspora that they may be able to return. So let's start with that. What is the lure of the diaspora to go back? What is at the heart of what you could call Iranian patriotism? Because obviously your father went back, and there had to be some lure for him to take his family back to Iran.
Of course. Tehran is, Iran, especially the people from different cities, including Tehran, the capital, everybody wants to return because there is so much beauty in that country, so much kindness, warmth, unity, that just that strong emotion that exists within people in that country has a certain connection, especially with the older crowd. You know, my father in the book, you know, when he took me back, he wasn't a teenager. Obviously, he had me, and I was, in my teens. But he still, I mean, of course, the reasons why we went back wasn't because he missed it. But part of the reason was that he wanted to also live in his country, and he really adored his country, and he still does. And I think many of the people his age have that perspective. They just love Iran. They love the memories they've created back in the day. They want to create new ones. And there's just this energy and aura about that, the warmth and the kindness of the people there that attracts them back.
Well, it would seem that there's been an enormous pent-up expectation that this nuclear deal would lead to an opening of Iran to the rest of the world. And I suppose in that context, the suggestion is that the Iranian people, at least the young, the intelligentsia, the urban folk, have been chafing under the isolation and the international, being something of an international pariah. Is that your understanding?
I don't really understand your question. Are you saying that what tourism is going to increase?
No, I'm not. I'm talking about there appears to have been a tremendous expectation and a hope that this deal would come through. And I take it that that's a lot of that's to do with the collective desire on the part of many Iranians, particularly the young, the intelligentsia, and indeed the business community, that they want to get back into the world community from which they have been ostracized, in effect.
They want to feel connected. It's like a family. You know, sometimes you divorce some people in your family, and now, you know, in different ways. I don't really comment politically, but some ways you sometimes divorce a group with another group, but there's always a sense of connectiveness within that group because you had that connection with it before. And, you know, they always want to connect again. There's no reason not to, but then not even that, they want to. For example, myself, I love it, but you know, sometimes there are some factors that I do bring into perspective if I do want to go back.
So in terms, though, of when you talk about this country that you love and this beautiful country with people that want to live a life of joy and pleasure and, I guess, mm-hmm. prosperity, too, how does that picture gel with the idea or the fact that this is a theocracy? I mean, for an American audience, I guess it's difficult to understand what life under theocracy mm-hmm. would be. I mean, I guess we could say, you know, if Rick Santorum was president of the United States and these...
You know, are we focusing on the book? I think we're getting really more on the nuclear deal than on the book.
Well, the book is about an experience, isn't it?
Teenage experience.
Yeah,
the
I understand
world
that.
World of teenagers.
But it's also about the culture shock or whatever you want to call it, of going from an American culture into mm-hmm. this Iranian culture. And that seems to be at the heart of what's happening now in the broader context. I mean, maybe this is purely a nuclear deal and that doesn't involve anything more. But my understanding is that there's an expectation that this will lead to a thaw in this, what, 40-year-long dysfunctional relationship, which you described as a broken marriage?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I believe in diplomacy. Again, I don't really comment on politics in any way, but I believe in diplomacy and unity and moving forward. So if that does provide that to any nation, I'm pro for that. And in this specific case, it's a country that's very close and dear to my heart. I consider myself an Iranian-American, being raised in Brooklyn, and then continued my life in Iran and then back. So, yes, in answer to your question, anything that promotes that, I'm a proponent of. And even in my teenager years, which I pointed out in the book, that I had a very difficult identity crisis because I was so Brooklynized. And then in Tehran, I had to learn the culture, and it was very difficult for me with the New York mindset to learn that. I still, you know, I welcomed that unified culture between what was in me and what was given to me, presented to me. So, and I think that's the beauty of experience. You know, it's an experience, and via that experience, there's education. I don't recommend it, you know, moving, especially in that age, moving back from, especially the United States. I mean, many European countries, maybe a little bit different, but especially of the United States of America, New York, I feel is such a different mindset. Going from that strong, opinionated, fast-paced environment to Tehran, which is also fast-paced, but it's very difficult to accept the culture for, number one, a teenager, number two, with the limitations that they have on female teenagers, and number two, three, just adapting, especially at that age, and in any age, on a broader perspective and a panoramic view.
So in terms of the most heated years in Iran's modern history, I take it you were, and the story also encompasses with your character, Delkash, which I take it is based upon you.
That's me. Yeah. I think 90% of Delkash is me, yeah.
Right. Did you and Delkash experience the so-called Green Revolution?
To some extent. The thing was that I was so Americanized, and I was more into... you know, when I went from Brooklyn to Tehran, I was so into bike rides to Coney Island and watching, you know, hunks with six-packs playing punch-ball in the park and so into eating pizza. And this, I wasn't really into the history, what was really happening in terms of the politics. And what I wanted to know is that how do people date in this country? How do people communicate in this country? How do girls talk about guys? But the thing was that every time we went out, it somehow connected with the religious, political theme of the society, because I realized that a lot of teenagers have to put on this mask that you can't really speak openly about having a boyfriend. And that's different from the traditional part, because a lot of countries, you know, the dad is very conservative and he doesn't allow the girl to have a boyfriend. But there were religious cops in the street. So, you know, you had to make a plan that if you wanted to go out, number one, you have to bypass the father and mother, the parents. And number two, you have to bypass the religious authorities that if you get caught, either you pay them some money. You get arrested, which is the bad part of it. Or either you pay them money and you're off the hook, or you say this bogus story that we're stepbrother and stepsister and we don't look like each other and we're having a cup of coffee, something of that sort. So when I was taken to Iran, I was getting to become familiar with all of these cultural things. And then via the cultural ones, I got to understand, I actually hit a lot of the other aspects of, you know, the Islamic Republic of Iran.
So describe the religious cops, because it's, as far as I know, the only other country that has religious cops is Saudi Arabia, where they have the Mutawa. But are they vigilantes or are they official? And what are they looking for? What are the violations that you as a young girl would be subject to? What would they pull you over for?
The religious cops, and I have it in the book too, they're called comité. And just like any other, you know, if we have the NYPD or the LAPD and we have the regular cops in Tehran, which, you know, deal with the criminal offenses, there's the religious cops. So, for example, and you have male and female religious cops. So you have the male ones that, for example, if they arrest a female, they can't really, you know, cuff the female because the guy can't touch the girl. So if the female has bad hijab, which is if the scarf is kind of falling off of her head, or if she's waiting, if she's wearing something inappropriate, because you have to wear a coat, which is called a manto, or the more religious ones wear a burqa, or the chador, you know, if it's inappropriate, they'll call you out and they say, hey, you can't wear that. And they'll ask why you're wearing it, and then it goes from there, you know, depending on the answers that you give or how harsh they could be. And so you have to be careful of that. And then, you know, God forbid you get, you know, caught in a party. I remember my first boyfriend was in Tehran, and he was always very cautious that we had enough money that if, you know, they did, you know, crash the party, we would have enough to pay them off. And some of them you couldn't pay off because they were saying, no, you have to, we have to shut down this party, and we're going to arrest the people in the party. So those were the things that I didn't know when I was a teenager, and it was so unreal for me why somebody would do this. It's none of your business, or beeswax, you know, I kept saying myself in my head, in my teenager brain, and but I learned to accept it. And the time that I went to Iran was very different from post-revolution, because post-revolution, you know, it was a revolution, everything was new. The time that I went, people had figured out already how to deal with the situation, and I learned from that. And there was a little New York City underground Tehran, which, you know, the book is very clear on the New York City life that Tehran has. That's one of the most fun, one of the most, you know, I could say if I would redo it, if I would go back, I would probably want to be in that era, even though there was a lot of resentment from me to my parents because of the move that they had. But I had a lot of fun. And some of my best memories and friends are from that era.
So tell us how, in this sort of New York City underground, and as your book points out, you know, you grew up in a Jewish Italian neighborhood of Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And your
Bensonhurst.
Yeah, your idol was Seinfeld, you know. So that's quite a transition. But tell us about that underground, and also about how you put on a party, or what kind of, you know, deceit and subterfuge do you go through to put on a party so that you don't get busted?
Well, putting on a party is easy. Just maintaining the party, you know, keep the noise level low, or, you know, if the neighbors are kind of like you, you know, let them know that you're having a party so they don't call, you know, the religious authorities to come crash the party, break it up. You know, putting it together was, well, not in my stance, because my dad was very strict on me, but a lot of, you know, and in the book I have, you know, a lot of the girls that were having parties, and we went to their homes, and, you know, their parents were very liberal. They had all lived in the States and were graduates of Berkeley and all these major universities, and had come back to live in their beloved Iran. So they were very open. They would host the parties, but they were very, you know, they were Upper Tehran, number one. In Upper Tehran, you kind of have the same way of thinking, unless, you know, there's someone that thinks differently. And sometimes, you know, they think differently, but they also mind their own business. So we always had to be alert. And I remember, you know, one time they did crash a party, and we were escaping from the windows, which was, you know, kind of fun in its own way. But you kind of have that risk of getting caught, which was kind of creepy. Like, what am I going to... The thought of getting caught wasn't even on my mind. What am I going to tell my dad was on my mind?
Well, do you see a day when those religious strictures will be eased, or do you think that is just the nature of the Islamic Republic and it's not going to change?
No, it's been eased now. You know, as time progresses, it's easier now than of course, I don't know. I haven't been back. But from what I hear, it's easier now than it was at my time. But there's still, it's not an open thing, you know, where you send a Facebook invite and, hey, I'm having a party in my place, or having a New Year's Eve celebration. It's still under the covers, but it still exists. And I don't know if it will ever go away, because, you know, having alcohol in the house, and, you know, this is an Islamic country, and it is a Muslim, primarily it's a Muslim country, so they go by those... you know, by Islam. And I don't know if it will ever be very, you know, free to have that kind of freedom like we have here. But I know that people have gotten around that, and they're very happy, you know, they're very happy, and, you know, I wouldn't say they're happy because of the, what's going on. Of course, with this deal, they're very happy, and I'm very happy. But, you know, they want to be free to be who they are. They don't need to have a mask.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your book and your and this conversation. Shageye Fasijani.
You said my name very well and my last name. You get kudos.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Shageye Fasijani, who was a former reporter and anchor turned author and poet. She was taken back to Iran at age 15 when her father made the unilateral decision to uproot the family from Brooklyn, New York. Upon her return, she traveled the world extensively and decided to share her story as a young woman during some of the most heated years in Iran's modern history. Her new book, The Burden of My Red Lips in Tehran, reveals how female teenagers adapt and conform to life in an oppressive society while navigating its many obstacles. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the massive demonstrations in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, against the legislature's naked voter suppression and blatantly discriminating laws. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, who's a recently retired professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases. His writing has been published in The Washington Post, The Guardian, Swimming Magazine, Endurance Magazine, and The Independent Weekly. He was arrested outside of the North Carolina State House while peacefully demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And were you in that huge demonstration that took place on Monday in Winston-Salem?
Yes, I was. I was glad to be there. I wore my white coat and was marching with an enormous number. I think it was about 6,000-7,000 people of all ages, all races, all religions. It was terrific.
And, of course, you're there to demonstrate and to add support to the challenge that's going on in the federal court there in Winston-Salem, which the state's voter suppression laws are being challenged by the Justice Department, the NAACP, and the League of Women Voters. And these changes to the voting laws in North Carolina, specifically HB 589, they were apparently approved in a kind of, what, a midnight sneak attack. No debate. So describe how these laws that rolled back voting rights in North Carolina so radically, how were they brought about?
So just to give background to your listeners, in North Carolina, we had some wonderful provisions which had had a dramatic impact on the percentage of eligible voters voting in elections. So we had, I think, over 2 weeks of early voting. We had same-day registration other than on voting day. We had voting on Sunday. We had a large number of places where people could vote. We also had that you could pre-register high school students age 16 through 18 so they could get a sense of the process. They couldn't actually vote until they were 18. And you could cast provisional ballots if you went to your voting place and they said, no, you're not registered here, you're supposed to go to this other place. You could cast a provisional ballot there that once it was straightened out, that ballot would count. And as you know, what happened is the Supreme Court on November 9th, 2012, in the case of Shelby County versus Holder, they struck it down on June 25th, 2013. They struck down Section 4B, which certified that some states had to get preclearance. And because they struck down those states, including North Carolina, Texas, Mississippi, and South Carolina, it meant that Section 5, the preclearance requirement, was not applicable. When that happened, literally within the week, our House, our Senate, and our governor signed into law getting rid of same-day registration, cutting the early voter days by almost half, requiring a very strict voter ID, considered the most strict in the nation, and I think that was it. And then subsequently, they also closed voting sites. So on college campuses, the one on UNC was closed. There was an egregious example where there was a voting site on a traditionally minority institution was closed, and a new one opened on a white evangelical Christian campus. So it was quite egregious, and the changes. And so this is what we are fighting against.
Well, indeed, one of the country's leading election law scholars, Richard Hassan, has called these changes in this new law that's being challenged in the federal court in Winston-Salem the most sweeping anti-voter law in at least decades. And just to reiterate what you said, you know, because of the Section 5, the heart of the Voting Rights Act was struck down by the Supreme Court, five justices voting in 2013. Immediately thereafter, the North Carolina legislature went to end a law that allowed same-day voter registration, which was used by more than 90,000 North Carolinians in the 2012 presidential election. It eliminated a week of early voting, which made access to the ballot box easy for 900,000 voters that same year. And the law ended out-of-precinct voting as well as pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, which had been hugely successful, particularly getting young voters to the poll. Now, what's interesting here in terms of the Supreme Court, not only did they enable this voting suppression, which, as you say, happened immediately out of the gate as soon as the Supreme Court voted down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Last October, a federal appeals court reinstated the same-day registration and out-of-precinct voting, and they went on to say that this was a textbook example of what the Voting Rights Act is supposed to prohibit. But days later, the Supreme Court stayed that ruling and allowed the entire law to remain in effect for the 2014 election. So, I mean, as bad as the North Carolina legislature is, the Supreme Court doesn't look much better.
Yes, and it's disturbing because if you look at Section 2 of the Voters' Rights Act, and remember, this is a 50-year-old law that was passed in the wake of, you know, the murders of the school children in the South in that terrible time. So people died for that bill to get it in power, and no one has actually challenged the results test. And the results test, Section 2, is quite interesting. What it says is a sort of a general prohibition on discriminatory voting laws, and it says the result, because it says it prohibits any voting practice that has a discriminatory effect, irrespective of whether the practice was enacted or is administered for the purpose of discriminating. So there's been a district court decision on 1984 that upheld that, and subsequent decisions at the level of the district court have upheld that, but it's never the Supreme Court has never ruled on it. So I think that this is these areas are very interesting, and you're right, the Supreme Court has not been open to this, and I think they've been naive, frankly, about it. And the perfect example is what happened. You may recall that a member of the North Carolina Republican State Committee, a board member from Buncombe County in western North Carolina, was taped by Asif Manvi on Jon Stewart, basically making racist pronouncements about why they passed the law restricting voter rights. So it had nothing to do with protecting the sanctity of the vote, et cetera, et cetera. It had everything to do with discriminating against minorities, and making it more difficult for people to vote, which makes absolutely no sense.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, who's a recently retired professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases. His writing has been published in The Washington Post, The Guardian, Swimming Magazine, Endurance Magazine, and The Independent Weekly. He was arrested outside of North Carolina State House while peacefully demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. And of course, that is the famous Moral Monday marches, which have gathered steam over the years and seem to have certainly come to a head on Monday in Winston-Salem, where the Federal District Court is looking into a challenge to these blatantly discriminatory and nakedly voter suppression laws that the North Carolina legislature has enacted. What's your sense, though, of is there sufficient national attention? I mean, I've always been amazed, Dr. Vanderhorst, is how in this country, the home of the brave and the land of the free, where we celebrate democracy, which we just did on July the 4th, that people can be so blatantly against people voting. You know, you celebrate democracy and voting, but then you turn around and try to stop your fellow citizen from voting. It's never made any sense to me, and I just wonder, can you name and shame these people?
I know. I think they're very sophisticated. The right wing is incredibly sophisticated at the way they use language. So they change the issues and obfuscate. So rather than talking about voter suppression or obvious racist statements, they talk about protecting the sanctity of the vote, rather than saying that we want to, you know, invade women's privacy in terms of both access to contraception and safe abortions. They say we're protecting women by requiring abortion clinics to have these standards, or their doctors who provide abortions to be registered at local hospitals. So they use this language that, if you're not paying close attention like you are, then you would think, oh, this is reasonable. Yeah, we want to protect the sanctity of the vote. But you've got to look at what the reason they are putting these in. And the reason they are putting these in is to discriminate against minorities. And I'm speaking as a white physician who's a one percenter in terms of my income, that these are absolute racist laws to do that. And the same thing, they're anti-women laws in terms of abortion and access to contraceptives. That has nothing to do with protecting women. It's the most anti-women legislation you could think of.
But will it have the effect of, since these laws that were struck down, they were used by, the same-day voter registration was used by more than 90,000 people in the 2012 presidential election in North Carolina, and the early voting, which they've eliminated, that allowed 900,000 voters to go to the polls in 2012. So does that mean that in 2016, in the next presidential election, that 90,000 fewer North Carolinians will be voting in terms of same-day voting? So if you total that up, that's almost a million voters that have literally been struck off the rolls.
Yes, it's conceivable to have a devastating effect. Remember, in 2008, Obama won North Carolina, which was a huge shock. We were a southern state that voted for Barack Obama. And 2012, he lost by, I think, about 100,000 votes, which was incredibly close, and the closest of any of us losses, I think. So obviously, if he's losing by 100,000 votes and you're eliminating a million voters, you're going to change the elections.
Well, that's what it's all about, and that's what I say. You know, in spite of the way they dress this up in language of their deep concern for the sanctity of the vote or the sanctity of life and all of this other cynical propaganda they put out, the results speak for themselves. So how do you think there's going to be a breakthrough here in terms of kind of national consciousness? All of those people... go ahead.
I think there are three factors that will eventually change. One is that, and we're using all of them, two is, one's just natural history, that in many of these states, as children age up, minority children age up and vote. So Hispanic voters, Asian American voters, etc. You've got people moving from blue states into the South for jobs and things like that. I think that this will have a devastating impact on the Republican Party. I think the other thing, I'm being cynical here, which has been a good thing, is that the Republicans have been so broad in their targets in North Carolina and in many other states. So they've gone against the unions, they've gone against women, they've gone against immigrants, they've gone against minorities, they've gone against the elderly, they've gone against children. So the schools they're destroying, so parents are upset. So when that happens, they've been so broad in their overreach, then you create a huge coalition like we have in North Carolina where people, this was deadly hot. There were 94-year-old people there who've been protesting since the 30s. Rosanelle Eaton was there. She's 94 years old. It was 90 degrees, close to 100% humidity. I was soaked through to my underwear, through my white coat and everything like that. People drove, elderly people came 4 hours from the mountains or from the coast to be there, white and black and rich and poor, because they're so upset about it. So that broad coalition helps keep the middle, who aren't aware of the issues. So I think that's been very important in North Carolina. And thirdly, the rest of us who do have resources, we give money to pay for these court cases. And we've got court cases against the school voucher program, against the redistricting, against the voter legislation, against every aspect, against restricting abortion rights. So everything, we're tying them up in knots with these court cases.
Well, just in the last minute, in the past 2 years, judges have struck down voter suppression measures in Wisconsin and Texas, which, of course, have been enacted by Republican legislatures. And these hearings have exposed the nature of these naked voter suppression and blatant discrimination. So is that going to happen in North Carolina, do you think?
Well, I hope so. I'm cautiously optimistic, because what happens when you do a lawsuit, then the opposite side has to produce documentation, so emails, et cetera, et cetera. So with that, then we're cautiously optimistic it'll expose their nefarious deeds.
Well, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, a recently retired professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina Center for Infectious Diseases. His writing have been published in the Washington Post, The Guardian, Swimming Magazine, Endurance Magazine, and the Independent Weekly. And he was arrested outside of North Carolina State House while peacefully demonstrating against laws he saw as hurting children and the poor. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.